Welcome back to Fontenelle. And in today's episode, we'll be taking a look at sepsis. Sanjay Patel, consultant in paediatric infectious diseases, joins me to talk through this emotive and topical area in a wide-ranging discussion, covering the definition and physiology of sepsis, the design and use of sepsis screening tools, the management of sepsis, and how the fear of sepsis is driving the rise of broad-spectrum antibiotic use, which, of course, we're all trying to avoid. He suggests combating this trend with start smart and focus, meaning target your initial choice of antibiotics to a probable diagnosis rather than treating blindly. And after the course becomes clear, perhaps the child improves or the focus becomes apparent, narrow your choice of antibiotics. And if blood cultures are negative at 24 hours and the child's clinically better, simply stop. That's right, if blood cultures are negative after 24 hours of receipt in the lab, they are highly unlikely to grow a pathogen. And Sanjay says we need to become braver about stopping antibiotics. Sanjay also talks about the kinds of individuals more at risk of sepsis, and also the special case of babies under 3 months who, being at risk of late onset sepsis, are currently nearly always treated with IV antibiotics, ideally after a full septic screen, based purely on a temperature of 38 degrees or more. Though, as he explains, with the advent of new vaccines and potentially point-of-care testing, this practice may well change in the foreseeable future. Hi again, Sanjay.
Hey, hiya.
Great to have you back on the podcast. And today we're going to be talking about sepsis.
Yeah, a really topical, emotive area that has gained a lot of media coverage and emphasis over the past couple of years.
And why is that?
Well, there have been some really high-profile deaths from sepsis in children and adults. And NICE put some energy into developing some guidelines for sepsis on the back of that. I think the message from NHS England was that any deaths from sepsis are potentially avoidable, and so a huge amount of energy has gone into trying to reduce the number of adults and children dying from sepsis.
What are your thoughts on the sepsis screening tool?
Well, it's a really good question. I think it's really good that there is an emphasis on recognising and thinking about sepsis, and that's the big mantra that's out at the moment, think sepsis. And I'm sure you've seen it in loads of the documents you've encountered over the past couple of years. The approach is a really sensible approach. Sepsis is a physiological process. It's all to do with perfusion of end organs. And the way you diagnose sepsis is to take a physiological approach to it. So you look at physiological metrics such as the heart rate, the respiratory rate, the urine output, the peripheries, the level of consciousness, etc., etc. And that's fundamental to the diagnosis of sepsis. The challenge is that the tools we have clearly don't have a sensitivity and specificity of 100%, which means there are a lot of false positives because that's the way that these screening tools have been stacked. Clearly, we would be mortified and missing a case of sepsis. So the sensitivity is very high. But in order to have a high sensitivity from a screening test, the offset is low specificity. So you have a load of false positive results. And as you know, in this area for hospitals, we use the PEER sepsis screening tool. It was developed in collaboration with many of the hospitals in Wessex and has been trialled and evaluated, and a head-to-head comparison of the Wessex screening tool against the NICE sepsis guidelines was conducted a couple of years ago, and encouragingly for us, it shows that our tool has a very high sensitivity, so we have very few false negative tests, but our specificity is far higher than the NICE tool. And that's because we've adopted a 2+1 approach, so we need two physiological metrics to be abnormal, and that's the heart rate, the respiratory rate, the oxygen sats or the temperature. And in addition, we need another factor to be abnormal, which is either activity levels, work of breathing or circulation. And if you meet those metrics of 2+1, you trigger the screening tool. NICE is different because it doesn't take a 2+1 approach. And so in our experience, when we did the head-to-head work, all of the children presenting with bronchiolitis or moderate to severe bronchiolitis triggered the sepsis screening tool. So the false positive rate was much higher.
And you knew that this wasn't the diagnosis. You know the diagnosis is bronchiolitis, but you're triggering this sepsis screening tool.
Indeed you are. And I think that's the real challenge. There's so much focus and emotion surrounding sepsis that our experience has been that if you trigger the sepsis screening tool, the approach taken by many clinicians is that that means that you've got to go down the sepsis 6 route and you've got to start IV antibiotics. That isn't how any of these sepsis tools have been developed, including the NICE sepsis screening tool. The output from the screening tool, if you trigger it, is senior review from an ST4 or above. And that's what we really need to get that message across. Triggering the tool does not mean you have to start antibiotics. It means that you've got to have the child reviewed in a timely fashion and then that senior clinician to make a decision.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's easier said than done because we're all increasingly risk averse, I think. Society is increasingly risk averse and that has also permeated clinicians. And so I've seen a number of senior clinicians really struggle to not start antibiotics, even though in their heart of hearts they don't think this child has sepsis.
Yeah.
I think it's still really important to make it clear that triggering this physiology-based sepsis screening tool does not mean that you have sepsis. Clearly, the majority of children that trigger the sepsis screening tool do not have sepsis. And that's because in this country, we have an extraordinary program of vaccination. So the classic organisms that cause sepsis, which were pneumococcus, Haemophilus, meningococcus, we now have really effective vaccines against. So your pretest probability of the child with deranged physiology and undifferentiated fever, the pretest probability of it being sepsis is lower now than ever before. And I think that is important because there is a huge move to reduce unnecessary antibiotic use because of the absolutely true danger of antimicrobial resistance that could render the antibiotics that we are so reliant on completely ineffective. So although I think at this moment in time it's absolutely right if you think it's likely that a child has sepsis to start broad spectrum antibiotics, I think in the future that may change. And I think we may have better point of care diagnostics to give us an extra bit of information about what's likely to be a severe illness versus a less severe illness. I think that we should be more comfortable in observing children in a safe environment. And I think it's really important to say that even if you do or don't start antibiotics, having robust systems to watch their physiology after they've come to us is essential. Because what you don't want to do is admit a child for sepsis at the start of a night shift, get super busy, run around A&E or the neonatal unit for 12 hours and then come back to see that the heart rate, the respiratory rate have increased over that 12-hour period. That doesn't tend to happen because we use PEWS scores and early warning scores now in children. But it's really important that that concept of re-evaluation is embedded in the management of sepsis because even with optimal treatment, which may be antibiotics and some fluids at the beginning, the child may still deteriorate. And you need to recognise that in a timely fashion to then intervene.
So what would lead you then to decide that a child is not septic? What would reassure you if you are triggering on the sepsis screening tool? Obviously, you're going to take a good history and it's all about the physiology.
It is. I think that's a really important question. And I think the principles of this recognition of sepsis apply equally to primary care clinicians as they do to secondary care clinicians, because the big step, if you meet your whatever this system you use to query or to raise the possibility of sepsis, is not one based on a shed load of investigations or complex tests. It's one based on basic physiology. So you're absolutely right, you take a decent history. So often, and nearly in all pediatric cases, your entry point is either a history of fever or a presentation with fever. And so I think it's important to broaden this discussion to what is one's approach to the child with fever. Mm-hmm. And that's where history and examination is really important, because if the child's got a classic viral upper respiratory tract infection and other members of the family have recently been infected, that's really reassuring that this child has got another diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And if the child looks extremely well, I think you can leave it at that. If this is the sort of child that you think should never have come to ED or to primary care, I think it's quite important not to overdo the examination, mm-hmm. because otherwise you're just giving a message to these parents, well, actually, you needed a doctor's stethoscope to manage your child. You don't. Increasingly, we're really keen for parents to manage more and more at home using sensible safety netting advice. But say if you in ED or primary care get a child with an undifferentiated fever or a child that looks unwell, it's essential that you measure some observations. Mm. It means that you do have to measure the heart rate of the child. You've got to measure the respiratory rate. You've got to look at the work of breathing, the level of consciousness. You've got to ask about urine output. Ideally, you've got an oxygen sats probe, but we know that in primary care, that isn't always the case. Mm. Not all GP practices have pediatric probes, which is something that probably needs to be addressed, especially if we've got so much emphasis on sepsis. It is a really important metric, actually. Yeah. But my approach is I take a physiology-based approach to whether I think the child is likely to have sepsis or not, then it's essential to know normal ranges.
Yeah.
Totally essential. So on the Healthier Together pathways for primary care for sepsis, or on the sepsis screening tool, on the PIA website, we've got normal ranges, and we've got abnormal ranges that should identify the clinician to some kind of physiological abnormality. And based on that, that's would raise concerns about sepsis or not.
Just looking at the screening tools, so I mean, any febrile child really that comes into a primary or secondary care setting, if they're febrile, they're going to be tachycardic, might be tachypneic as well. They're going to be triggering this.
Well, I think it's right that they're going to be tachycardic and tachypneic, but the numbers on our screening tools reflect the 95th centile for normality. Mm-hmm. And so there is a lot of evidence about what's a normal heart rate or breathing rate in the febrile child, and there's adjustment has been made for those.
So these are adjusted figures.
So these are adjusted figures that really should identify the child with more than the physiological mm-hmm. increase in heart rate or respiratory rate due to fever. Well, so it should suggest either hemodynamic instability mm-hmm. or respiratory compromise.
Yeah, because the plus one on here as well, so altered mental state, for example, again, if you're febrile, quite often the child will be irritable or miserable.
Well, and I think that's why it's important to, for the child in the grey area, is to have a more liberal approach to the sepsis screening tool. And I think it's important to try and see what the effect of, say, paracetamol is. Mm. So if you can bring down the fever and the child perks up and the obs normalise, then you're not triggering the tool. And that's slightly probably easier for us in secondary care, because
Definitely.
We've got the ability to observe a child
we've
for 4 hours.
Yeah.
I think it's harder in primary care. But I think that systems do need to be in place to allow us to observe children. If you're really sick and you're triggering everything and you're off the scale for heart rate and breathing rate, then immediate action is essential. If you're in primary care, that means get the child straight to hospital by ambulance. You don't have to give them antibiotics in primary care. What we say is if your transfer time to hospital is less than 60 minutes, they can do all of it there. Mm. You obviously have to alert the hospital that you think this child has sepsis so that there's a team waiting for them on arrival. But in secondary care, my observation has been that we start antibiotics first and then potentially think later. Mm-hmm. And my feeling is that we need to redress that a bit. And for a child with query sepsis, we can observe that child. And they're with us. We can see the trend on the heart rate, the breathing rate. If a child's got sepsis, those observations will worsen in the absence of treatment. Mm-hmm. And then we can intervene.
Okay. So what is the definition now of sepsis?
So as of last year, the definition's changed. We previously used to have the term septic shock, severe sepsis. Now we talk about sepsis being life-threatening organ dysfunction, mm-hmm. which is where all that physiology stuff I mentioned to you earlier is highly relevant. So heart rate, respiratory rate. The reason your heart rate goes up, as you know, is because you're trying to maintain your cardiac output. Sepsis involves capillary leak, so you have less fluid in your bloodstream. Starling's curve, you may remember that from medical school, is all about preload. So if your preload goes down, you need to increase your heart rate in order to maintain cardiac output. That's why your heart rate goes up. Basic physiology. Respiratory rate goes up because of a combination of acidosis and pulmonary edema. So that's your, in order to oxygenate your blood, you breathe more quickly. You have cool peripheries because there's redistribution of where your blood's going. It goes to essential organs like the brain, etc. You have altered level of consciousness because you have inadequate perfusion eventually to your brain. Same with your kidneys, which results in reduced urine output and eventually anuria. So that's the definition of sepsis. Septic shock is where you've got significant hemodynamic compromise. So you're then needing fluid boluses, you're needing inotropes, you're hypotensive, etc.
And with that hemodynamic compromise, is that getting to the point of hypotension, or would you say that just having tachycardia is already hemodynamic compromise that's just compensated?
So for the definitions, the new definitions of sepsis really put that septic shock as that level above where you're getting to that point of hypotension. You know, that's a late sign of sepsis. Things are looking pretty bleak by the time you're hypotensive, but it's really moving towards that. It's that where the mortality goes up significantly if you've got septic shock as opposed to sepsis. Our approach, as you know, is, you know, that term, the sepsis six, is something we use, and our approach to sepsis is that you've got a golden hour, you've got to manage things in a timely fashion, you've got to give your child oxygen, you've got to give them fluids, you've got to take out blood cultures, and you've got to start broad spectrum antibiotics. If things are not improving despite 40 mils per kilo of fluids, then you need to be thinking about inotropes and you need to be thinking about elective intubation, because actually that reduces mortality. But all of that very complicated stuff is beautifully algorithmic. It's on the SORT website, and I'd really signpost people to that. But I think the harder bit about sepsis is the child with fever, undifferentiated fever, because it causes great anxiety for clinicians, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It's very common. And if there's so many of these children coming in, any one of them potentially could be septic. It's teasing out who is and who is not. So
I think one thing to keep in mind is that you've also got to think about the patient and patient risk factors. So far we've been talking about physiology, haven't we? But there are some children where I have a lower threshold. If I'm in the grey area about whether this is sepsis or not, I'd have a lower threshold to start antibiotics. And those are young children. Children under 1 year of age have a higher risk of sepsis. Non-immunized children, definitely, because we know that our vaccines that we've introduced in the past 10, 15 years are incredibly effective. Those who have recently had surgery, and we sort of say in the 6 weeks following surgery, you're at increased risk of infection. Obviously, if you're immunocompromised, and that can be a primary immunodeficiency, so that very small number of children I look after in my clinic, or the far greater number of children with a secondary immunodeficiency, which can go from sickle cell disease related to their spleen, to children on steroids, to all of these new monoclonal antibodies we use for rheumatoid arthritis and things, to the child with nephrotic syndrome or a protein-losing enteropathy. So there are loads of children with secondary immunodeficiencies, and also recent chickenpox. And recent chickenpox, as you know, is highly potentially associated with invasive group A strep. And we have a lot of group A strep circulating at the moment. The clade, the type of group A strep we have circulating in the UK in the last couple of years, seems to be more aggressive than previous clades. So it's just something to know about. Always be mindful of the child with a new onset fever after recent chickenpox.
And is there a time frame that you'd be thinking
well,
of?
Well, I would say till all the lesions have healed up, actually. Yeah. That would be the kind of the logical approach to it. It's because you've got a break in your skin.
Are children with chickenpox more at risk because of the skin being broken, or is the chickenpox also affecting their immunity?
Very good question, and probably a combination of both.
And then you've also got your children who are on chemotherapy who may be at risk of neutropenic sepsis.
That is a different group, and I think it's absolutely right to think about those. With those, we've got a far lower threshold. Any child who's neutropenic, one of our oncology patients, we call it febrile neutropenia, don't we?
Yeah.
We dive in with antibiotics because they're risk of overwhelm. They've got central lines in. They're a very group. I think it's important to probably focus on the otherwise healthy child, because that's the one that actually causes more anxiety, because it's a lot grayer in my mind.
Yeah. And that's got to be part of your written and verbal plan that you hand over to the nursing staff, hasn't it, as well?
It does. I think it's really important that our nursing colleagues know why we want OBS to be done. So the child that presents with a head injury, they're doing a specific set of neuro-OBS to look for raised intracranial pressure. For the child presenting with sepsis or query sepsis, they're doing a specific set of OBS, albeit the same OBS, but they're looking for a different physiological response. They're looking for hemodynamic instability. And so really important that we have those conversations and we implement the right training for our nursing colleagues so that they know the importance of doing these OBS and acting on them if they become abnormal.
Let's talk about safety netting.
Really important. I mean, in the presence of robust safety netting tools, I think both we as clinicians and parents feel more comfortable and more reassured. And what I mean by that is we need to make it clear what would worry us in the coming 4 to 6 hours. Mm. And parents need to be absolutely clear what those things are. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to achieve through our safety netting resources. And we put a huge amount of time and energy and consultation into developing the ones we have on the Healthier Together website. And the feedback from clinicians and parents has been excellent in terms of reassuring them. And the impact of that is twofold. Firstly, that if a child deteriorates, we want them to come back in a timely fashion. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a number of cases where that initial reassurance from a face-to-face consultation delays subsequent representations to the point that harm comes to the child. Mm-hmm. And we need to make it absolutely clear to parents that we don't have a crystal ball. That although at this moment in time the child does not have sepsis based on physiological parameters, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that in 4 to 6 hours that may not be the case. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fundamentally important, mm-hmm. If we are to reduce mortality from sepsis in this country. But the flip side of that is not having parents feeling so anxious after consultation that they come back after 12 hours just because their child still has a fever. Mm-hmm. And so that's the other potential impact of robust safety netting sheets. And we've seen that in Southampton on our assessment unit, that if you effectively safety net, far less patients come back. And we've not had a signal of lots of children coming back with sepsis because they didn't come back. So I think it achieves two things, both of which are fundamentally important.
I think as clinicians now, we're becoming extremely aware that we should be avoiding giving too many antibiotics or giving antibiotics unnecessarily. Isn't this high awareness of sepsis increasing the number of antibiotics that we're actually using, or are you not seeing that?
It's an excellent question. We are seeing that metric. So when we look at national data in children, we are definitely seeing a rise in the use of antibiotics, the ones that we tend to use to manage sepsis or treat possible sepsis, such as ceftriaxone. It's really hard to know how to answer that. I think that the emphasis on sepsis means that people, if they're not sure, are starting broad-spectrum antibiotics. I think, as I said before, in the absence of really accurate tests, point-of-care tests, that trend will probably continue as we become increasingly risk-averse. It's really important to stop those antibiotics in a timely fashion, and that's the principle of antimicrobial stewardship. And we use this term start smart then focus. So starting smart means you think there's a good chance this is a bacterial infection, in this case sepsis. You take adequate cultures and the other investigations you need to do, and you start those antibiotics, the correct antibiotic, in a timely fashion, and you base that decision making on your local guidelines. So as you know, we have empirical antibiotic guidelines for Wessex on the peer website. We have almost the same guidelines implemented in primary care. So that's the start smart bit. An important bit of the start smart bit is if you do have an alternative diagnosis such as pyelonephritis or pneumonia, you treat pyelonephritis or pneumonia, you don't treat sepsis. And that's because the recommendations for those infections may be a more appropriate antibiotic, more targeted for the likely organisms, better penetrating that bit of the body, such as the chest or the kidneys. So it is important to try and make a diagnosis at the start smart bit. But with time, it becomes blatantly obvious for most children that we manage that they don't have sepsis. And that's done in terms of their physiology, looking at the trend on heart rate, respiratory rates. It's looking at their inflammatory markers. And so we do have the ability to do things like CRPs or procalcitonins. We do them at baseline, and then you repeat them at 12 hours, 24 hours generally. And if there's not been an uplift in them, that's very reassuring. You get your blood culture results back. Mm. And although historically we've already always said you've got to read your blood culture at 48 hours, that mantra is changing very rapidly. And lovely data from Portsmouth is that you can read your blood culture at 24 hours. 24 hours after it gets to lab, if it's still negative, incredibly unlikely you're going to have a pathogen growing after that.
And how sensitive is the blood culture?
Oh, that's a good question. And they're not 100% sensitive. So the sensitivity of blood culture is somewhere around 50-60%, assuming you take an adequate volume of blood. It goes down if they've been treated with antibiotics. But that's part of the jigsaw. I think if you have a combination of a CRP that's not gone up, a blood culture at 24 hours that's negative, a child who remains well, our approach within the Children's Hospital and within our OPAT service has been to stop antibiotics at 24 to 36 hours. We have to be braver at stopping antibiotics.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We still cause great harm in terms of antimicrobial resistance if we continue antibiotics just in case.
Okay.
And I've used that term before, I think, just in case approach, but it definitely applies to sepsis, because if you're left with a diagnosis of, say, tonsillitis that requires antibiotics, absolutely, then you treat it. So if at 24 or whatever, 36 hours, you've made an alternative diagnosis, manage it. But if you ruled out sepsis and the only reason you started antibiotics was to treat sepsis, you stop antibiotics. The child can still be febrile. We know that the average duration of fever with a viral infection is potentially 4 days. But as part of your safety netting, you would say to the family, if your child's still febrile after 5 days or has developed a new onset lump in their neck, which is painful, etc., etc., then they come back.
Okay, so you briefly mentioned earlier about children under 3 months of age, and they really are treated quite differently, aren't they? They've got their own separate pathway.
They have, and that's because they are at far higher risk of an invasive bacterial infection than older children. And that's because they are still within that time period in which they can get late onset sepsis. And what that means is that organisms either acquired at the process of birth or acquired early in life can cause severe infections.
Mm. And so that would be the group B strep type picture.
It would be the group B strep, E. coli, and in some places listeria. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So those are they're a different set of pathogens to the ones that we generally think cause sepsis. And so our approach to those children is to have a much lower threshold for investigations. So they come in, if you've got a fever above 38 degrees and a child under 3 months of age, they need to be assessed in hospital. And they need to have a septic screen. And they need to, in general, they are generally started on intravenous antibiotics. Mm. We can still stop them after 36 hours if their investigations and physiology and blood cultures are all negative, but we have a much lower threshold for starting those children on antibiotics. When we have better point of care tests, that may change. We may even get to the point where we start observing some of those children. But for now, the general approach adopted by pretty much all paediatricians is under 3 months with a fever, need to be assessed in hospital, need to have a septic screen.
Yeah, and that includes an LP before antibiotics?
It does include an LP. I mean, the group of children where there's a little bit more greyness is those children with bronchiolitis.
Yeah.
Although bronchiolitis doesn't usually cause an extremely high fever, children are often febrile, can be febrile with bronchiolitis. And I think if you've got a classic phenotype of bronchiolitis, there are a number of people, including myself, that wouldn't necessarily insist on doing a septic screen.
Yeah, and the 3 months is more of a sort of probability. Is that the reason for the cutoff? The closer you get to
That's right. So it's clearly
people often
not
ask
the
me,
same.
Why 3 months?
Yeah, so it's 3 months because late onset sepsis, so neonatal infection, can present up to 3 months of age.
Yeah.
But it's clearly not the same probability at 2 months and 29 days as it is at 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So there is a gradient. And after 6 weeks, it becomes less likely to be late onset sepsis.
Yeah.
But we still say 3 months.
Yeah.
That might change.
Okay.
But it's different. What's interesting there is that we've introduced all of these new vaccines against kind of the classic pathogens that cause sepsis. We don't have any vaccines against the late onset sepsis organism. So we don't have a group B strep vaccine, although we perhaps will relatively soon. There are some being trialed. We don't have an E. coli vaccine.
Mm.
So That's why our approach to the older child with undifferentiated fever and query sepsis can potentially be different, because our pretest probability has dropped markedly over the past 15 years, whilst our absolute probability of late onset sepsis hasn't really changed at all, because we have no vaccine. So it is interesting.
That could really change practice then if we do get the GBS vaccine.
We would potentially be vaccinating pregnant women. That's where the trials are going on, in pregnant women being vaccinated. It would be a complete game changer, because it's all to do with the pretest probability. And if your pretest probability drops significantly, you think of petechial rashes being another example. We have been obsessed about meningococcal disease, and so any child with a petechial rash beyond the SVC distribution with slightly deranged inflammatory markers starts on broad spectrum antibiotics. The absolute risk of a child with a petechial rash having meningococcal disease is lower now than ever before, because of the vaccines. And so we have to potentially change our approach to the empirical use of antibiotics in that group of patients. So you're right, if we had vaccines against the organisms that cause late onset sepsis, we could adopt a different approach as well.
Great. Anything else?
No, that's amazing.
Well, thank you so much, Sanjay, for this comprehensive look at the current state of sepsis recognition and management. I really like the way Sanjay acknowledges how hard it can be to positively diagnose sepsis on initial presentation, since it usually presents with fever or history of fever. And the most common cause of fever, as we know, is a viral infection. And we may never find the source of that. So the sepsis screening tools in their various guises, including our 2+1 tool here in Wessex and Thames Valley, are there to grab our attention, get us to take a closer look at the physiology, assessing the heart rate, respiratory rate, saturations, work of breathing, urine output and level of consciousness. And what I've been told by my astute friends in the paediatric intensive care unit is that the level of consciousness is the last parameter to go off, since cerebral perfusion is maintained at the expense of nearly everything else. Sitting up and chatting, therefore, isn't always reassuring. Having said that, if you have diagnosed sepsis, go straight to the sepsis 6, which means giving oxygen, getting access and bloods, including a gas, cultures and glucose, giving IV antibiotics, considering giving fluids, involving your seniors, and if 40 mils per kilo of fluids haven't restored hemodynamic stability, consider inotropes. I'll put a link for more information about the paediatric sepsis 6 in the show notes. For our local guideline on the management of sepsis in children, go to the SORT website, and here you can also find links to the Wessex and Thames Valley sepsis screening tool. I do hope you've enjoyed this episode of Fontanelle. If you have, please do subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and share with your friends. Contact me, Caroline Story, at fontanellepod@gmail.com for any ideas or suggestions you have for future shows, and I will get back to you. But for now, from Fontanelle, goodbye.